Welcome everybody to our second New York Historical Materialism Conference, session number one, Financial Crisis in the United States of America. I'm very happy to be here with Bill Tabb and Gary Dimsky. And today, because unfortunately Mary Robertson had to pull out, she wasn't able to attend, so we mourn her absence, but that means that the other presenters will be able to have a little bit more time to present their amazing work. So first, we're going to kick it to Bill Tabb, who is going to talk on financialization, the appropriations of finance, and the restructuring of American capitalism in our time.
That title was the title of a book I was writing when they asked me what I wanted to speak on. And Columbia University Press, in their wisdom, thought it was too long, and who would buy a book with that kind of long title? So this summer, if you see the restructuring of American capitalism in our time, that's still me. I've organized what I want to say this morning into four parts. The first defines and describes financialization, what it is, in the context of the social structure of accumulation perspective, and I have to talk about what that is. And that's the second, situates these developments in a theory of endogenous financial crisis. A third employs structuralist and instrumentalist theories of the state. And a fourth discusses the misdirection of public concern from the culpability of banks and other segments of finance to the need to downsize the government, fire public workers, and basically screw over the rest of us. Now, that's far too much to do in the time I have, and I struggled with trying to either cut it or decide on parts of it. But what I'm going to do is go as far as I can and then stop trying to sum up at the end. But I thought I would start by making the points that I think are significant, even if I don't get to defending them in my time. The first is that the acceptance of financialization as an accumulation strategy has changed the strategic orientation of corporate governance, not only in the United States and England, where an Anglo-American variety of capitalism prevails, but really everywhere. You think of the Germans or the Japanese with more corporatist ways of organizing their economies have in the last 20 years moved increasingly closer to the Anglo-American model. And so that what we have is a privileging of disinvestment from our economy, which has been important in the conservative offensive to redefine the state and citizenship entitlements. And what I want to do is try and draw the connections between those changes in the underlying dynamic of American and indeed some other capitalisms and the political effect that we're feeling so dramatically. And despite rear guard resistance, there is broad analysis that the economists' mainstream understanding of efficient market theory, and efficient market theory, you know, markets always work, they allocate resources efficiently. You'd think after the collapse we've just gone through that this theory would sort of be ushered off and a little realism would take its place. There's no indication in the mainstream that that's happening. There is, in fact, continued defense of efficient markets as if it never happened. Alan Greenspan, who you may remember did it before a congressional committee, found a, quote, flaw in his libertarian way of understanding the economy and that it was actually full of shit and that that's not how things work. Well, a few weeks ago in the Financial Times, he wrote an op-ed basically recanting his recantation and saying that there's no way government can regulate markets, financial markets should be left, and government will only mess it up if they intervene. So it's been a real, once the banks were saved, a real movement back to an intellectual framework which will allow the banks once again to run the same stuff and I think get us in the same trouble, but at a higher and more expensive level, where a number of countries will not be able to bail out their banks. And those include the UK, where in London, the Financial Services Administration, run by a really smart and farsighted fellow, is looking at really imposing controls on banks headquartered in London. The same thing is going on in Switzerland, because the size of the banks located in these countries are so much larger than their entire economies that if they go again, those governments will not be able to bail them out. The story will be more like Ireland or Iceland than it would be like the United States, where the bailout was actually very successful for Wall Street. Okay, and the last is this concern of even establishment figures that with financial reform failing, that you will get for both structuralist and in a Marxist theory of state framing, both a structuralist and an instrumentalist understanding of why regulation will not work, cannot work, given the constellation of political forces, the dominant historic bloc in America now, and so on. They understand that and are fairly worried about it, which is interesting, but it doesn't matter because the Republicans will continue to shill for their contributors, and the Democrats, as we've seen with Obama, have to back away because the money to win an election was switched so profoundly, so totally from Democrats to Republicans in 2010 that the Democrats understand the limits of the reform they can politically get through and have any hope of retaining influence in Washington. So that leads to the misdirection of attention from the culpability of finance capital to displacement onto alleged state incompetence, public sector workers, social spending, and so on. All right. Having just said all that, probably half my time is done. Financialization. The term denotes the dominance of the financial sector in the totality of economic activity, such that financial markets determine the state of the overall economy, and the financial sector demands dictate non-financial corporate behavior. Okay? That in dictating non-financial corporate behavior, what I mean by that is the short-term time horizons of corporate boards of directors and the extraction of what would be called surplus, but the profitability of corporations, so that instead of profits being reinvested in expansion of production in the United States, they are distributed two ways. One, to venues abroad, but second, to stockholders, so that the people who own the stock are getting back, both in higher prices of stock and in dividends, the value created in production. Because it does not make sense to reinvest money in the United States. It's a slow-growing economy. Income in this country has been stagnant now for 30 years. And so there's no need to expand capacity. That any Washington plan, for instance, for accelerated depreciation on new investment, any of that kind of stuff, will not work because new investment will take place when there's demand for additional goods and services. Absent that demand in the domestic market, and given the increased productivity of American workers, you have a situation where you can have recovery of the stock market and 10% unemployment or 9% unemployment. But of course, you understand the real level of unemployment is, if we count the people who've given up looking for work, the people who are working part-time but want full-time jobs, the people who've gone back to school because they've been laid off and hope to find something else, you're talking about 20% of the United States with very serious labor market problems. And then, of course, there are people working for wages that they can barely live on, leading to credit card debt, student debt. You probably don't know about student debt. But last year, it passed credit card debt as the largest single category of debt, as young people have been forced into, because of higher tuitions and all the rest of it, into this kind of situation. So financialization captures all of these changes where the economy is dependent on the creation of debt and where the dynamic of investment is in speculative activity, where asset appreciation, either real estate, people's homes, or collateralized debt obligations, or other derivative products, are purchased with the expectation that they will rise in value. And so later on, we will have what I expect to be two really excellent presentations on the way that plays out in the subprime crisis and in the geographic distribution of that. But it was that is part of the larger financialization of speculation in assets. Now, a few numbers. From 1980 to 2007, and here I'll give you numbers for the world and then for the United States. I don't expect anybody to remember these, but they give you an order of magnitude. The world's financial assets, including equities, private and public debt, bank deposits, quadrupled between 1980 and 2007. In this period, you had a tremendous increase in profits going to the financial sector, so that it, for the United States, corporate profits of the financial sector in 2004 were $300 billion compared to $500 billion for all the profits of all the corporations in America. So Wall Street, basically, and related industries, was taking 40% of all the profits of all the corporations in America. In the 60s, it was about 2% to 40%. We've had this steady increase as financialization has become the driver of our economy, so that while the standard of living of working people, measured by their real income, is stagnated, you get this tremendous appropriation of surplus by finance from workers and the productive sectors of the economy. A tremendous change in the structure of capitalism in this era, which is sometimes called global neoliberalism, conveying both the globalization of economies, no longer an international economy, but a single global economy in which workers in different places are increasingly part of a single labor pool, and where investment is cross-border, production is in commodity webs across the globe, and so on. Neoliberal in terms of tax cuts, privatization, contracting out government services, and all those other wonderful things we're seeing going on in New York and throughout the country and around the world. So global neoliberalism is a social structure of accumulation. And social structure of accumulation is a framework that maintains that periods of growth require a coherent set of mutually reinforcing institutions favorable to capital accumulation. And SSA analysts, everything gets abbreviated, social structure of accumulation analysts, look at American history and can see discrete social structures which change through American history. And it's an interesting literature which some of you may want to be involved in or explore it if you're not familiar with it. Okay, so we have relations within every social structure of accumulation. And here I'll just briefly talk about the two most recent, the national Keynesian structure, which is the post-war structure, and the global neoliberal, which comes in around 1980. And in the book, I run down all sorts of data points which show 1980 as just a discrete shift in trend line for all sorts of things, debt creation, up to 1980, American wages and worker productivity went up together. After 1980, productivity kept going up, wages did not. Debt increases and the share of finance, all of this stuff, it works really pretty well. That in each social structure of accumulation, there's a stable understanding between capital and labor. In the post-war period, the liberal labor alliance, recognition of trade unions, large corporations, accepting UAW, the steel workers, the other, that these unions had won struggles in the 30s through the 40s, and it was accepted that trade unions were legitimate and part of the fabric of the social structure. The United States and the rest of the world, a different understanding before Reagan than after Reagan. Capital in the state between, and so on. Citizens and their government, what was expected as entitlements, what we could consider legitimate and what now is considered legitimate, and the struggle over redefining these in the new social structure. So the meaning of events, the likely outcomes, are predicted over a relevant planning horizon with enough confidence to have an expectation of consistent expectations. So firms sort of knew how it worked, unions knew how it worked, citizens knew, you know, you had that. And then you have a shift to the imposition of a very different set of social and institutional structures in this way. Okay, now students of historical materialism understand that developments in the forces of production create pressure for changes in social relations. The accommodations of a particular social structure of accumulation come under pressure as technological possibilities change the bargaining power of economic actors. In any given situation, different outcomes are possible. It's not a deterministic framework. It's open to struggle, contingency, what happens. And in the period we are in right now, it is an amazingly open period. It's incredibly open and could go in very different directions. I'm not going to speculate, but the events in Wisconsin, the general awareness of so many Americans that if it just keeps going this way, the future is not good for the territorial American economy, U.S. economy, even though U.S. capital is continuing to do very well. At the end of the talk, which I'm sure I won't get to, I quote Barack Obama, whose perspective is to increase American competitiveness. And we've heard his speeches on this. And parts of this are quite positive, you know, more money for education, infrastructure, industry is the future, alternative energy and so on. I'm all for it. But the framing of competitiveness, to say that General Electric is not competitive, globally, it is incredibly profitable, competitive, and investing in Brazil and China and doing very well. The competitiveness framework is an effort to put capital and labor in this country on the same side against China and others. In a class perspective, it's much clearer that transnational capital and international finance have higher profitability now than they did before the crisis, while American working people look forward to a future that is much less attractive. So that underlying these, that's my 5-minute warning.
Sorry.
Underlying these globalization imbalances and fragilities is a lack of investment opportunity in the United States. And so progressive people, liberals of all kinds, including people who would consider themselves more radical, say, look, it's obvious what to do. The Army Corps of Engineers has this long list of dams that are about to fall, bridges that are falling, the West Side Highway collapses. That's because they were all built in the 1930s, the last great economic crisis, where the New Deal and the political coalition supporting it demanded jobs for the unemployed to do the work that the country needed. And of course, that would work today as well. It would be harder because you have to deal with the international stuff, and you would have to make changes in, for instance, taxation of transnational capital and transnational corporations. You would need to move to global level taxation with the taxes collected globally, distributed in my schema in three ways. First, to countries based on where production takes place. Second, where the goods and services are finally sold. And third, a component that would go to the bottom billion people in the world in terms of development assistance, income support, and so on, to have a leveling up rather than a race to the bottom. In that way, the rich could not avoid taxation. Corporations could not use the Grand Cayman Islands, which is now the fifth largest money center in the world. It exists in basically one building down there with about 150 to 300 mailboxes for Google and, you know, IBM and all the other big corporations for their tax returns. But of course, it's all electronic. They have no real economic presence there or in any of the other tax havens where the tax avoidance takes place. So the need to recapture the surplus that is now being appropriated by transnational capital and finance has to be done in a very different way and could be done. I mean, when it's a question of terrorists, they do a very good job of tracing even the smallest organizations' financial movements. It can certainly be done, but of course, globalization, financialization are projects of the most powerful factions of capital globally, and the states that represent them are not very anxious to do that. However, if they don't do that, and if this escapes taxation and being recycled into public functions, it can only go into further speculation, into new economic bubbles, and into worse things the next time around. So on the one hand, it's a very pessimistic sort of overall analysis. But on the other, it's the kind of thing that, you know, I talked to people in the 70s, I spent a lot of time talking to people who've been around in the 30s, and they said, for the first couple of years after 1929, nothing happened. There were no political movements. There were people trying to get things going. Didn't really, you know, they worked hard, but. But after people saw that the situation had fundamentally changed and was not going to change in their favor unless they became active, we began to see a very different movement building and so on. So I don't predict the future, but the analysis is not a positive one towards the trajectory. And it does suggest that either we see the kind of activity that we've had in other periods of our history, or we're in real trouble. I'll stop there. Thank you.